Welcome to the Phoenix Unlimited Podcast.
Hi, how's it going, everybody? So, thanks for tuning in, downloading the new episode of the Phoenix MMA podcast. This one is gonna go over. The focus is gonna be the Flow Grappling event, the WNO Felipe Pena versus Nick Rodriguez. So, my thoughts on the event and all the drama and the hype and everything surrounding all the subjects and stuff. So, a bunch of good talking points when it comes to professional jiu-jitsu, which will cross over to, it'll have some crossover with MMA as well. Some of the drama, I'm not a big fan of normal drama, but when there's drama around competition rule sets and actual something that actually has to do with the competition, I don't mind drama or a good debate to entertain him. Just when it actually has like a relevant point, it's more interesting to me. So go over that. First thing, just updates on what's been going on the last few weeks or last few days. So we had the state tournament for wrestling this weekend. We had three of our students that qualified for state, Cameron, Xavier, and Halle. All three of them placed second in the sectional tournament, so that qualified them for the state tournament. I'd have to check. I got to check with Cameron. It might be the first time that all three of them have qualified for the state tournament. So if it's a step up for competition, it always takes. It's pretty tough to perform to your best ability the first time that you do a step up in competition, just because the size of events. It's not always the case, but it's pretty common for it. Your first time that you do a national championship, a world championship, or a state championship, it's tough to perform at 100%. The nerves, lots of times they call it UFC jitters when people come from a smaller organization to the UFC. It's similar to your performance difference from in the gym when you can just free flow easier. And until you overcome the performance anxiety, where at the gym you're operating at 95-100% given on the day, and then in competition you're competing at like 85%, and it's and once you unlock that, then you can go to your full competition, because your performance will, once you get past the competition anxiety and you can hit a good flow state, you'll actually probably, you know, hit like 110, 120, 130% of your normal self. You will get a little bit of boost from just hitting a flow state and being a creative state. And you should eventually do better in competition than you do in the gym, because in the gym, you're not being as competitive. You're not as heightened sense, and you're doing round after round after round. So you're going to make more mistakes when you're switching up, doing different rounds, and you're working on stuff. Results from that, Xavier lost by 1 point to the kid who got third place. Cameron got sixth place in the tournament, and Halle got fourth place. So quick little review on all three of them. Xavier is a very good athlete all around, really good wrestling, really good jiu-jitsu, really good at boxing, really good at kickboxing. Xavier's main thing he needs to improve on is and everybody has different personality styles. This isn't even that you have to change it per se, but Xavier's a slower starter, which isn't bad, because if you're going to go in a long competition, like a 5-round fight, title fight, that can pay off. Instead of being like a Conor McGregor, like a sprinter, he's a slower starter, like a Gordon Ryan would be a slower starter as well. But it works better when you're going for a longer term competition. So if you're a slower starter, you need to do a more intense warm-up than someone who's a fast starter. you need to, since you're a slower starter, if you're in a short competition, then you need to do a more intense, longer warm up, so that you're stepping into the match and you're already halfway through a workout. That's when you start feeling the best. So if you're a slow starter, that'd be the thing. And then Xavier's, it's just a self-belief. Xavier is really, really good. But there's still a level that he's trying to crack and break through, which I remember when it happened for me. And one of my coaches, Jim Casey, he's a psychologist. I remember him working with me on it, talking to me after practice. But there were so many tournaments where I was getting really, really good, but I would just get to that. I would get to that top point, the top three medal podium, and then I would cause myself to lose, or I would give up in some way. And it's not like you just flop to the mat and give up. It's somebody gets in on ankle pick, and you, by giving up, you like freeze for a moment, or like have some brain fog, and sometimes you will just concede 2 points easier than you should have. But you can't. Real confidence comes from experience, and it takes time to get there. Lots of times people say, like, hey, you just act comp, fake it till you make it. It's like, no, faking it till you make it works in bars and maybe in high school or something like that, but not in combat sports. When you're running into objective reality, you can be as confident as you want, but once you feel the skill of another person and the strength and the power and the flexibility and everything, artificial confidence dissolves like really, really quick. A lot of the toughest guys, once they actually step into a wrestling tournament, jiu-jitsu tournament, the toughest guys that, or MMA fight that on the street talk a big talk, they crumble, and all of that confidence dissolves really, really fast. Honestly, most of them won't even sign up for a fight or a tournament, because they don't have enough confidence to get to a fight or tournament. It's just false bravado. But I can remember very clearly when that kicked over, and it was the Nogi Worlds at Purple Belt, and I had never placed in a major tournament before, but the Nogi World Championships, I remember I was signing up, going to all the tournaments. I was winning local tournaments, but the Nogi Worlds was the first time that I really, really that I really broke out and got past that, where I started believing myself. And it still was by accident. I was just taking it one match at a time. There was no secret. There was no secret unlocking thing. There was no Dragon Ball Z, like, unlocking Super Saiyan. I mean, there kind of was, but it wasn't like a coach. It wasn't a lesson. It was acquired this through experience. And for me, I was taking one match at a time. I signed up for the tournament, and because I'd never placed at a major tournament before, I didn't expect to win the tournament. I was just excited to go, and I was going to do my best. I took one match at a time, and I won at match after match after match. And then next thing you know, I looked up, and I was in the, I mean, I say it next thing, I won in the semifinals. And I remember I was just excited to win in the semifinals. That placed me in the finals. And I was just so excited that I was in the finals, because that meant, oh man, I guarantee I get second place. And getting second place in the Nogi World Championships, this was insane for me. I was so excited. And then the guy I was going against is a guy named Ari Farias. And Ari was, like one of the hot prospects. He was already a multiple time world champion as a teenager, and he had come into the adult brackets, and also he had like the who's who. He had like Andre Goval in his corner, Ronaldo Jacare in his corner, Lucas Leitch, like all the current world champions, all the best people. It was like, imagine if I don't know, just any major, LeBron James or Tom Brady had like a little cousin or something who was 19, and everybody's like, oh, he's so good. And not only did they say he was good, he's already multiple time world champion as a teenager. So that's who I had in the finals. So I honestly thought, like, I'm just going to go out there and have fun. I got nothing to lose. I'm just going to have fun. And I didn't even really, I say didn't try to win. I was trying to win, but I didn't think I could win. I thought the skill gap was going to be so big that the first half of the match, I was not really being offensive when I should have. But I actually got really, it was a really close match, and I had a couple opportunities to win the match. And that was not even counting the first half of the match that I didn't, I didn't take risk and go for opportunities like I should have. So after that match, I remember my coach, Robert Drysdale, telling me, he's like, that's it, Corey. Like, you're here. You've done it. He was like, crossed over that. Like, Ari was supposed to just smoke you. It was supposed to be, domination. He was supposed to run through you, but he didn't. And he was like, that's it. Like, from now on. And then, that's what clicked for me, but it wasn't a false artificial confidence. It was, I had to see myself do it. And it was just a lot of work, a lot of preparation. And then when it finally lined up, that broke the seal for me. And then going forward, I expected to win, just every major tournament I got in, I expected to win. And when I would lose, it was easier. Even when I would lose, it was easier for it to slide off my shoulder, because it just didn't stick. I was like, well, I've been in the finals before. I've gone against, you know, the current world champion, and, you know, I just made a mistake, and I'd be able to see it for what it was. I made a mistake on this sweep or this takedown or whatever it was, and it could slide off. But you can't fake it. And that's where Xavier is. He's very, very good, very talented, great athlete. He's just going to have to keep on plugging away at that. And then when it unlocks, it's going to be really cool, because when it unlocks, he's going to be unstoppable. It's going to be pretty cool to see it. But just a matter of time. Like this, I could also say it's similar to cigarette smokers. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, but I've read about quitting cigarettes, and that it actually takes multiple times to quit smoking. And those, the first few times, like say the first three or five attempts are failures most on average, but those first five attempts at quitting smoking they're not a waste of time. What happens is every single time that you try, you stretch it out, you get a little bit tougher, more resilient, and then you fail and you go back to smoking a little bit tougher, but you build up. So the exact same way that you build, cardio, the same way that you build muscle, it's the same way you build confidence. But the reason why I went off on that tangent was I was talking to Hunter Duff about this. I've been talking to Halle about this, and it pertains to Xavier and Cameron as well. And there's going to be other people in the gym too that it pertains to. So if you're not confident when you're still not confident with competition, that's what it felt like for me. And that's what I would, this is from my experience, what it actually feels like, and to get real competition confidence. it can be faked. And that's I'd say the blueprint or how the timeline of how that happens. Cameron placed sixth place. Cameron's really dedicated. He wrestles in the off season. I just don't have a ton of details on Cameron's wrestling, because right now he's been doing jiu-jitsu less and Muay Thai less. He's been just doubling down on wrestling, focusing on, most of his practice is all Wilson Central, especially during wrestling season. But Cameron, I have to talk to him as well to see if there's any injuries or just any mistakes, or, it also can happen where, you have a very, very tough bracket, your weight class. So when it comes to the state tournament, one weight class can be super, super stacked, and the other one can be relatively light. And like the UFC, 155 pounds is insanely, insanely tough, and heavyweight is always pretty light when it comes to talent pool. Same thing can happen in wrestling. Halle, she did the best. It was awesome. She got fourth place. And it's just sick because it's Halle's first time going to the state tournament, and it's only Halle's second season wrestling. Now obviously she's training year round. We work on wrestling quite a bit. She's doing really well in jiu-jitsu, and she's already had a kickboxing competition, kickboxing tournament. She's done jiu-jitsu matches as well. So she's training year round. So her second season wrestling to place fourth place. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Halle could win the next 2 years that she's doing state. She could be a state two-time state champion. And I'd say if next year, if she still could be the similar timeline on the confidence where Halle's doing really well. She's good enough to win a state championship next year, but say she gets second or third place just off a mental thing, just because you get to the finals and it's the first time you've been to the finals for a state tournament. But I think we'll be able to pass that with Halle just because we'll have her competing year-round, so she'll have plenty of kickboxing bouts coming up and jiu-jitsu tournaments. So she'll have enough wins under her belt that she'll expect to win her state championship next year. So that one should be a surprise. Then next, upcoming things we have, upcoming fights, March 18th, we got the Primal show. Xavier has a kickboxing bout on that. Austin Swink has an MMA bout on that. And Cameron Tompkins has a kickboxing bout on that. The same day, March 18th, we have a Naga. For any jiu-jitsu competitors that want to compete, April 2nd, got the PKB tournament. That's the Point Muay Thai tournament. All of our Muay Thai students that are interested in competition that want to fight should do that. All of our MMA fighters that want to fight, want to compete, should do that. That's a great opportunity for experience. Don't waste that opportunity. If you can do that tournament and you're not, then you are wasting a huge opportunity. Again, everybody should do that. If you want to fight MMA, you want to fight kickboxing, everybody should be doing that. It's a cheap tournament to register for, and the last one we went to, they ran it very well. We were happy with the competition, so everybody should do that. We need to, one of the biggest things, like our grappling team, when it comes to jiu-jitsu and wrestling, we have a good competition team, and there really is no secret to that. The secret is me, Eric, and Kevin, we're going to do the best that we can coaching and teaching and motivating, but we can't go do all the competitions for, obviously, like the team. We are the coaches. We are not the competitors. So if you are an athlete, you're a competitor, we need you to step up and compete. Again, the jiu-jitsu program, like I've talked to one of our MMA fighters about it, multiple actually, that our grappling program, jiu-jitsu and wrestling, is doing very, very well. We have a great competition culture. It's doing well tournaments with our striking. That's all we need. We just need people to show up, people to compete. And there's not as many opportunities, so this is a great opportunity that you want to take it. I have people all the time that talk to me about wanting to do it. To be fair, a lot of our kickboxers, it's personality types, just can't, honestly, are not as dedicated and not as dedicated to training, because all the time people will tell me they want to fight, they want to have a kickboxing bout, and then when I tell them they need to train 5 days a week, then they stop coming to the gym, they stop training. So when you tell the truth, but you know, that's just, you know, there's a similar thing. It's not that jiu-jitsu people are more dedicated than Muay Thai. It has nothing to do with that. Each person is individual. But this is a great opportunity. Everybody should do this. The day before that, April 1st, we got the grappling games. Every jiu-jitsu competitor can do that. The Naga is March 18th. And grappling games is April 1st. So if you got to choose between those two, I would definitely pick grappling games. It's the tournament is run better. It's a much better tournament, and it's half the price of Naga. And it's double elimination guaranteed. The owner of grappling games, it's a small business. She actually cares about the competitors, that they have a good time, or that they have a good experience. You get two matches guaranteed. She tries to price the tournament at a reasonable price. And if you get screwed over by the refs, a bad decision, if you have video, she'll help you out, whether it's getting you another match, another division, or a credit for the next upcoming tournament. But she actually, her name's Amy, she is always there at the tournament, and she actually is hands-on trying to run it. Naga has basically the opposite reputation. The price is twice as much. The price is double. The company is so large that the owner of the company oftentimes can't make it to the tournament. The referees are very short. They're rude. They, Yeah, they're short, they're rude, single elimination. It's just, and now Naga is a great way to get a competition experience. I'm giving these critiques, but that doesn't mean I'm saying boycott or ban Nagas. If you want to compete, you need to be competing regularly. If you want to actually win something big, you need to, doing a Naga is better than nothing at all. You need to be competing. But if your schedule can only permit one, or your budget for competitions can only permit one, then I would lean towards the grappling games for that reason. The April 22nd, we got the IBJJF Nashville Open. That one, that's the International Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation. For all of our hardcore competitors, MMA fighters, and jiu-jitsu competitors, definitely I want everybody to do that one. So that's a really good tournament. It's a higher profile. It's going to be the highest profile tournament that will be in Tennessee. And our team, Zenith, if we have a good team show up, we could not only place in the top three as a team, but we can definitely place first place. And there's several people in the gym. And we've won the Nashville Open. We've had several divisions that we've won. And we could clean up. We could have a whole lot of medals from that one. And I'm going to compete in that as well. And then the week after that is the Gogi MMA show. We have Cameron and Xavier that we have locked in opponents for that event as well. So I know, long introduction, 20 minutes in. Now we'll get to the subject. Good work to all of our wrestlers of the state tournament, and good luck to all of our kickboxers, MMA fighters, and jiu-jitsu competitors over the next couple of months. We got a lot of stuff to keep us busy. So I apologize for coughing too. That's still clearing up from being sick the last couple weeks. So, the subject for today, the Felipe Pena versus Nicky Rod match and all the surrounding drama going on with it. So, first we'll go over the result, the decision. So the decision was for Felipe Pena, to win, over Nicky Rod. The first judge's favor was for Nicky Rod. The second judge's favor was for Pena. And then the final decision was for Pena. Me and Kevin, when we watched it, I initially, thought that I gave the decision, to Nicky Rod. That was my initial, thought on it. And then, from looking at the rule set, listening to Pena's reaction, Nicky Rod's reaction, and, Gordon Ryan's reaction, I'll give my thoughts on it. What I told Kevin last night was I thought it was Nicky Rod, initially. I thought that his late leg attack that he went for, his entry at the end, was really what sealed the decision for him. But I think there's more at play. I said the only other way that unless it was an error on the judges, and what I mean by error on the judges is they were not paying attention, they had a bias against one of the athletes. Or not paying attention or having a bad perspective. There are some judges that are not quality, have bad perspectives. If there was a logical explanation, that's what I started thinking. This would be specific on the rule set of who's number one. They don't clearly explain the rules, and the rules really, really matter. And the not having open scoring is an issue as well. That's what Eric's opinion on it was the phantom judging where it's sub only. It's really not sub only. There's still points, just the points are phantom points. And with that brings up the topic of penalties and phantom penalties. So the only logical way initially that I could think without any judging errors, but an actual real criteria that a judge could give, what they would say what Nicky Rod did was he could have been penalized multiple times for what he was doing, the actions he was doing. And if you watch Gordon Ryan's Instagram story from last night and his post that he put out today, that's exactly what I was saying to Kevin, was Nicky Rod and Pedro Mourinho have a style that's basically intelligently stalling. Gordon said it's the illusion of doing jiu-jitsu without actually doing jiu-jitsu. What that is the person on top will play on the outer perimeter. They won't they won't fully engage. They will play on the outer perimeter, and they make it look like they're going for attempts just enough to not get, you know, completely booed. But what it does is it will cause the bottom person to get frustrated. And out of the frustration and a combination of being fatigued because they're trying to sit up constantly, when they make an error, then the top player will then commit to an offensive attack. So this is, you know, and wrestlers are very good at this, like masters of rule set and playing out of bounds and scoring and doing, making sure 1 foot is in bounds so that you can score. But jiu-jitsu and grappling are trying to get away from that because then it's a matter of who's better at playing the rule set versus who's better at actually dominating the other person in a fight or a grappling competition. Which it's a sport, time and points are always going to be part of it, but that's what jiu-jitsu is trying to do, or submission grappling is trying to do. It's what ADCC is trying to do. It's the reason why Conan Duarte got so many penalties against Craig Jones when Conan was on top. I don't believe Conan should have got all the penalties that he got, but he did deserve a few penalties, and it's also why Buchecha lost to Gordon Ryan when he got penalized. And what that is ADCC is extremely strict on the top person. The top person must engage. So you can stand to pass, and you can move left and right. You can circle, of course. But every time that you take a step back and you disengage, you're being penalized if the person's on bottom and they're scooting towards you and you back away. Now, this is not just ADCC itself. You know, if you go wrestle, wrestling rules are very, very, wrestling rules are very similar, actually, in how strict they are. They're just strict from in the standing position. So, like, jiu-jitsu is not very strict at all when it comes to disengagement. When it comes to takedowns, you can back away all day and you can stall. It's the exact same problem from doing takedowns, the same type of thing where you frustrate somebody into taking a bad shot and then you hit a go-behind or you put them in a front headlock. But what you were doing was stalling the whole time. So wrestling has that solved when it comes to the referees. Like it's almost like you have two wrestling rules. I mean, you're in takedowns, the referee is almost like it's like two dogs being pushed into each other to have to fight constantly. But that's not the case with MMA. MMA, you're allowed to flee takedowns as much as you want. You can practically run away from your opponent. Jiu-jitsu is similar. You can flee as well. Jiu-jitsu is getting better where if you flee the mat, somebody has a single leg, they restart you in the center, but they give the person 2 points because you ran out of bounds. So they are disincentivizing that rule set. ADCC actively does it. They're the best at doing it, but the IBJJF is not far behind, or they're working on it as well. But on the actual mat, ADCC is the best when it comes to passivity by the top person or stalling by the top person. So the illusion of making it look like you're doing something, but you're really not. And to an untrained eye, if you don't know how to do it, then you just don't understand it. If you want me to show you, I can show it to you in the gym. I actually do it. How I know is I do it when I'm really tired in the gym. If I'm in a really tired round, then the person on bottom can actually dictate the pace. They can rapid fire attacks on you. So everybody has to do it at some point. It's just part of it. But that's where the rule set has to play in, so that people aren't just stalling, because then the sport will be more about who can stall better than who can actually do offense. Like if you throw 3 punches at somebody in a boxing bout and they block the 3 punches and back away, the person who threw the punches is always awarded the gives the favor in that situation because they're the one that's actually creating the offense or the action. What Gordon Ryan said with it was that Nicky Rod was given the illusion of doing jiu-jitsu without actually doing jiu-jitsu, which I agree with that opinion. And then would when was looking for an opportunity that he didn't create, Felipe Pena overexposes himself or gets frustrated, makes a mistake, and then he's capitalizing on the mistake instead of creating the opportunity or creating the escape with offensive pressure. So if you're wondering, hey, who like, okay, what's an example? Well, just about everybody else on the event did that, where they, on top, created the passes or the submission opportunities by offensive pressure. JT Torres did it. Jonatus Gracie did it. I forget the guy's name. He's a master world champion. I think Steven Martinez, he did as well. If I'm saying his name wrong, I hope I remembered it, but he did as well. Rene D'Souza Souza, but his was just a wild, there's different styles doing it. But Pedro Mourinho is very good at doing it. Mourinho's very good at doing it, and Nicky Rod's very good at doing it. That's where I could say logically, if what they're doing is, there were penalties that were issued to Nicky Rod that he just wasn't aware of because there wasn't open scoring. They call it sub only, but it's not sub only. There are points. They're just phantom points. And that's why I'm a fan for open scoring, because it's just better to know what's going on. If there's open scoring, doesn't make it more boring. It'll actually make it more exciting, because if you know if you're down by 1 point, then you have to attack, instead of both guys thinking that they're winning and they're banking like a near submission, and then they both think they're winning. So then the last 2 minutes, then they both conserve and stall. And the only other thing that watching the highlights that Nicky Rod and Penna put out, one thing that I didn't bank very hard in my head was Penis. I think he had a couple guillotine attempts that he went on, which the reason why they didn't really stick in my head last night was they weren't close guillotines. But also Nicky Rod's ankle lock, his last attack wasn't very close. He had an outside heel hook that when I first watched it, when you're in the heat of it, it's exciting because he's close to it. But he did have the heel, but Penna has a inside underhook on the leg. It's really hard to finish an outside heel hook when they have that underhook. It's what, I'm trying to think. It was, it's an AOJ, really good, Mendez brother student, really good black belt, when he went against, Taza a couple years ago. He was the same defense, and Taza couldn't finish the heel hook. I can't think of it. Yeah, I can see his face right now, but I can't think of his name. But I think that could have been the wash. It's like, okay, you go for a ankle lock that's not really close, and then I go for a guillotine that's not really close, and then it's who was stalling less, and then who was initiating offense, whether it's a sweep, a leg attack, or a guard pass. And also Nicky Rod, one of his good leg attacks came off of, I just don't know every little bit of the judging criteria for who's number one, but I do know in ADCC, for example, that if you're on top and you go for a submission, say you're top side control, you go for a Kimura, if you get bridged, you get reversed and they get on top of you, the person on bottom does not get 2 points, because they don't get rewarded for, the reason why is the person on top, if you go for a submission and you lose the top position, the other person doesn't get 2 points for a reversal, because the reversal was not initiated by them. The reversal was a byproduct of escaping your submission. So again, if you notice, the theme is they're trying to reward offensive people. The person who's trying to actually finish the match or trying to improve position, they're trying to not reward the person who is reacting and just countering and being defensive. Because if everybody does that in the sport, then it gets really boring. But wrestling, again, has already had this. See how long you can stall in a wrestling match before you get penalized. See how long you can stall in a judo match before you get penalized. I've heard that judo is even stricter than wrestling when it comes to the stalling calls, before you have to attempt an attack. Let me check my notes, see if there's anything else. With that too, like, we're going to, next week or this coming week, that's what we're going to work on, is how to deal with somebody who is staying on the perimeter and giving the illusion of doing jiu-jitsu instead of actually doing jiu-jitsu. And again, examples, JT Torres was right in the pocket, pass smash the whole time. Jonatus Gracie as well, and then also Gordon Ryan, all of his matches. When he's on top, if you notice, just even if you don't understand the actual techniques that are being done, when you watch a Gordon Ryan match, when he's on bottom, he's pummeling and attacking just about constantly and working for things. And the person on top is usually playing the perimeter and backing away from him, or they're just not engaging at all. Like the Gordon Ryan versus Kyle Bohm match, that's a good example of where Bohm just won't engage at all. and then Gordon has to use a deep half guard just to the sweep, just to actually get a connection and engage. And then on the reverse is when Gordon gets on top, he's always like a lead blanket or like a wave just crashing down on top of his opponents. So he's standing right in the pocket. They're trying to attack, trying to sweep. They're trying to do leg entries. And instead of playing the perimeter back and away, he's just stepping right in and attacking. So, there is a difference. There is a difference between like a Nicky Rod top game versus a Gordon Ryan top game. That's very clear to see. Or a Pedro Mourinho top game versus a JT Torres top game. There's a clear difference. I like that they are penalizing it. The same way if you're in a boxing bout and you just run away from your opponent for all 12 rounds, and you never initiate any offense, or you never that you shouldn't be rewarded for that. That's just, you're just running. Let's see. Okay, so yeah, the next week, just a little like teaser, what we're gonna work on next week. This is gonna be the importance of what we're going to work on this week, which is going to be heisting to an elbow, heisting to a hand, heisting to a knee, and being able to wrestle up as well. Wrestling up, it's one thing I noticed with Penna last night. Me and Kevin were talking about it. Penna really is an example of somebody who has not developed his wrestling, and it's a shame to be so good at jiu-jitsu and such a good grappler, but to not really develop your wrestling and your takedowns. Because he had an opportunity where his hands were locked and Nicky Rod's knees were nearly touching. They were so close together, just bound up. And Penna still just flopped to his back, which this is really common with hyper guard players like the Meow brothers. They have such a good guard and they'll have opportunities. There's plenty of opportunities they have to sweep their opponents. Meow versus Uriah Faber back in the day, and all the sweep opportunities that they get close. Once they run into wrestling resistance, they then flop back to their back. Sometimes it's the correct thing to do, but sometimes it's not the correct thing to do. Good example of somebody who made the adjustments, Rubens Charles Cabrinha, one of the best guard players of all time. I think Gracie Magazine gave him award, best guard of the decade from 2000, I guess it was, yeah, the 2000, maybe 2000, 2010, or 2010, 2020. But he had an amazing spider guard, De La Hiva, open guard, inversion guard. But then he became a student of wrestling and ended up out wrestling AJ Agazarm, just wrestling, not even using his guard at all, beating him at ADCC. And Agazarm actually had a wrestling background, high school and I believe college as well. Cabrinha had zero wrestling, nothing middle school, high school, or college, and out wrestled AJ. So you can do it. You can make the adjustments. And I think Cabrinha, I mean, he was a straight up just guard player. I don't think he started wrestling until he was in his 30s, late 20s, early 30s. So you can make the adjustments, but you got to decide to. And also with this is wrestling up is not the same as normal wrestling. So if you're worried like, hey, when I'm wrestling up, this person's a better wrestler than me on the feet, I'm not going to be able to finish the takedown. This is not true. They're not the same. Wrestling from the seated position on the mat, wrestling up is completely different than wrestling from standing position. The setups and the entries are different. The wrestling, one of the best skills of a really good wrestler are from standing position, the setups and the entries to get to a takedown. The problem is, if you got your hands locked on a college wrestler in a double leg around their knees, you can finish it. The problem is, from standing position, if your setups aren't as good and your entries aren't as good, you're never going to get to that position. But when somebody's on top of you and you're on bottom, you can get to that position much easier. So case in point, one of my old students, who's a two-time All-American, and one year was a runner-up. Same weight class, around the same age, and on the feet, I could only take him down out of 10 takedowns. I can take him down once or twice out of 10. He would take me down 8 or 9 times out of 10. But on the ground, that's when I noticed, like, oh, I can sweep, because sweeps work exactly, they're, again, not the same as takedowns. I can sweep. But then also with the sweeps, I started learning that, oh, okay, if I wrestle up, I'm in a super deep high crotch. I'm in a super deep double leg. So when I'm, if I'm there, I can finish it. It's just on the feet. He was really masterful, really skilled at not letting me get there. Exact same thing with submissions against a black belt. If you get a black belt and a really good arm bar and it's extended, you can finish them. There's no magic there. The difference is going to be, it's going to be really hard to set up and enter on a black, on an arm bar on a black belt. That's the difference. Or they're actually the same thing. So with that being said, don't just flop to your back, think that you, because you've never wrestled before, that you can't wrestle up, because you can. That's the biggest hole that I noticed from Penna in the match last night, is not integrating that. And this isn't just my own thought. Eddie Bravo's had the same thing about wrestling, even though the 10th Planet guys don't really wrestle very much. He's had the same thought. Craig Jones also predicted that seated guard to wrestle ups are going to be a big innovation in the next ADCC. Leg locks were a big innovation at one point, but that's Craig's prediction. But I've noticed the same thing. So now let's go over some of the drama. So the greasing problem. So me and Kevin were watching last night. A couple of things I noticed. It's annoying for the fans. The referee actually, with paper towels, started wiping them off. Penna had, said that he felt like Nicky Rod was greased. The commentators said that Nicky Rod had shaved his arms and legs. He could just be doing that for cosmetic, but also they mentioned that swimmers shave their arms and legs for to be able to glide through the water easier. You are more slippery when you shave your arms and legs. Just grip somebody who shaves their arms or legs and you'll feel it once you get sweaty. He could just be doing that for cosmetic, or he could be doing it because it works well for his style. He's been accused of greasing or putting lotion on pre-competition. This has been around since forever. MMA fighters been doing this since way back in the day. Put on lotion, you apply it to your skin like with a credit card, and you scrape it, and you put it on a few hours prior. Then when you warm up, you know, once you're actually sweaty, yeah, you're just super, super slippery. So if you got a good wrestler, a good jiu-jitsu guy you're going against, you just, do the lotion and credit card, slice it off. When you get felt by the commissioner or whatever, they can't feel it because it's in your pores. Once you start sweating, it comes out of your pores. And then you're like a slip and slide. It is a real problem for competition if people are doing it. And the thing you need to realize is that athletes are going to cheat. They are going to bend the rules and break the rules when there's money on the line, or even if there's not money on the line. I have two good examples of an example of cheating. I got my thumb dislocated one time. It was a high school wrestling match, but a guy that I was beating, he dislocated my thumb, grabbed my thumb, and has bent it back all by itself. That's a penalty. He knows it's a penalty. He wasn't a beginner and dislocated my thumb, but the referee didn't see it. So, like, that's a stupid rule, like, if your thumb's dislocated. Wrestling can be kind of like pro wrestling, where the ref's on the backside. They don't see the guy grab your thumb and dislocate it. Even though your thumb's dislocated, they still just let it go. That's a stupid referee, and it's like a pro wrestling. Like, if they can sneak in the steel chair and hit you in the back when the ref doesn't see it, silly stuff. But a lot of high school wrestling refs aren't in good enough shape to be able to run around and get a good perspective, and or they're being willfully blind. But I had another competition. This is also bad refereeing, but yeah, it's an EBI overtime. I actually starting on the back of a guy for EVI overtime. He started with a grip right on my thumb. And even when, as the referee was about to say go, I was actually saying, you can't grab my thumb. And then right away went to escape. The referee, but that one was a ridiculous thing. The referee was wearing like a t-shirt from Foot Locker. And I don't think he was actually a jiu-jitsu referee. I heard him that he was a referee for a local pro wrestling circuit in East Tennessee. So that thing just sucked. But athletes, when there's a lot of money on the line or a big title, they're going to cheat every chance they get. So you have to create rules. You have to have governing bodies, sanctioned referees, and sanctions in place to work it out as much as you can, because it's going to happen. It's just part of competition sports. People are going to cheat. I wish they wouldn't. And it really sucks for the fans, because like when that's the action gets stopped, it was, me and Kevin were frustrated watching it last night when that happened. But then also from the athlete's perspective, it's your career, it's your livelihood, it's your legacy, and somebody's cheating. It really does suck, because if you protest that somebody's greasing, if they got lotion on, and then you get booed for it, it's like, dude, I'm not the one that's cheating. He's the one that's cheating. He's the one that's not following the rules, and he's doing this for unfair advantage on purpose. Sucks to get booed if you're just calling out that somebody's cheating. You're punishing the person that's not doing the wrong thing, and that's not incentivizing like good proper behavior. It's incentivizing more cheating. My thought on it, my solution, like Gordon gave his solution of 75% purse cut, and then some type of penalty in the competition, like three negatives or something really strong that would affect the outcome. I don't think that's a bad idea. My idea is honestly just you could make lotion, or you could make Vaseline or whatever. You could list the same way USADA bans certain substances, like Adderall is a prescribed prescription Adderall, but also for the Olympics, caffeine in certain dosages. Once you get to too high milligrams, caffeine is illegal. So any commission can make anything illegal substance to be used during competition, even if it's for somebody's health. Like some fighters can't compete, or some athletes can't compete because they have to take specific medication just for their health, and then that will ruin it. And that really sucks if it's a serious medication that you just need for your life. This is not going to be a black and white thing. It always needs to be a discussion and a debate over what should be banned, what should not. But lotion, I'd be willing to bet that you could pass up your lotion for 48 hours, so your skin won't deteriorate in 48 hours from you not putting lotion on prior to a professional grappling competition. So if Nicky Rod's saying, hey, my modeling career will be messed up if I can't use my lotion or whatever. Again, that's what I say. It should be debatable, but I don't think that one would win the debate. You could make the substance and then make it clearly available, give all the information to everybody, give it to the public where, petroleum jelly, this is a bannable offense, and then you could have a swab test where you swab their arms, wrist, ankles, legs, and it's just really clear. And you just put that if the substance is found on your skin, then you'll be sanctioned and penalized. And the point thing, I'm not saying that's not a thing to do, or 75% purse, but you to actually stop people, because what Gordon's worried about is that somebody could cheat and then win the match, and then they could lose 75% of the purse, but they'll make more off instructionals and seminars and the clout and everything. And that is a real thing to be concerned with, like the balancing act. My suggestion would be to make the substance banned, make it clear that what's banned, and make it banned, make the public know. Like, make the public know the rule set so they understand what's going on. The public will hold the athletes to the fire as well if they know what's going on. The fans will. The fans will help. And the fans are the ones that are going to buy the instructionals and seminars. So, people vote with their dollars, and athletes are not going to want to hurt their entire fan base or run off their entire fan base. But let it be known, and do the swab test. And then, of course, it's going to take a little bit of time for the results. But just have it where all athletes have to sign a contract where they know what substance is banned from being on your skin. It could be ingested, you know, whatever rule set you want for your competition. Let's say where, you know, you pick the top 10 major lotion material substances, put those on the ban list, make them sign a contract for everything with the purse when they're already signing contracts and have it in bold where they understand what they're doing. And then where the penalty would be if the swab test after the event, if it tests positive, then you're fined 100% of your purse. So take 100% of the purse away. And then it honestly needs to be punitive at that point as well. And it could either be a ban for a certain amount of time, but a ban for a certain amount of time, that would suck. But if it's WNO, they could ban him for a year. He could just compete IBJJF and ADCC. Instead, I think a better way, the thing that will affect people the most is when you affect their money and a pro fighter's money. So, you know, you could have a heavy fine with it. So, like, they have to return 100% of their fight purse, their competition purse, and then, say, a $10,000 fine or whatever you want to do, $20,000 fine. You could do something like that. And then when people test positive for Vaseline on their skin, then you need to make it public so that they couldn't just get a big win, get $100,000 in instructional sales, and then pay the $20,000 fine, and they still like, hey, sweet, my legacy's bigger. I made $80,000 by still cheating. So you would adjust that wherever it needs to be. That would actually you need something that will actually painfully hurt in a way. So it needs to be a competition. It needs to be a combination of the media so that the fans know what's going on. So the media will put pressure on the anti-greasing and, cheating. The fan base will then do that with verbal pressure, but more importantly, where they vote and spend their dollars on instructionals and seminars and merchandise, and then also 100% purse, and then having a heavy financial fine as well, because you're knowingly competing. We let you know what substances are banned when allowed. And it was in bold, you signed it, you agreed for it. that would be my solution. And then I'm still not opposed to, you know, taking away a point or adding a point or something like that. I think every UFC fight, there should be, every time somebody grabs the cage wall, should be an automatic point deduction. It is a human nature thing to grab the fence, but you can, that's what martial arts is training human nature out of ourselves. And you would see if there was if they changed the rule, it was automatic 1 point deduction for grabbing the fence, you would see way less fence grabs. You would still see them on occasion. It would still happen. But what happened is that people would start training their mind and training their body not to do it. They would mentally rehearse not to do it. But they would do it in the gym as well. They would practice not grabbing the fence. And then at fights, they would do it as well. You would see less fence grabs. But if you can fence grab one good time and then you just get away with a warning, then, you know, I've made a joke and a theory that if you could, for a major title fight, as long as you didn't have a reputation of being a cheating fighter, you could, for a major title fight, you could get away with a major eye poke, one major eye poke, one major low blow, and one major fence grab, and that could change the entire outcome of the fight, and you could become a champion off of that, the change of the fight, and you could potentially only get 3 warnings for that, and all 3 of those things can radically change how a fight looks. Let's see. So my other questions I have for this, I guess, Gordon on his video, he said that he's seen Nicky Rod an hour and a half before competition, putting lotion all over his body, putting on his hair and everything. My first question, then, the first thing I thought was, why is this the first time we're hearing about this? So Gordon said that when Nicky Rod was on his team, that he saw it, but this is the first time we've heard about this. So it's interesting to me, and I wonder why Gordon didn't bring it up before when they were teammates. I can get not snitching publicly, but I'm curious if Gordon and Donaher came to Nicky Rod and say, hey, dude, we don't do that. That's not the way that we're trying to win. That's what I would do to one of my teammates or athletes. which I guess Gordon is not a coach of Nicky Rod. Maybe that would be more Donaher's job, but I would feel like as a coach, it would be my job if I found out that one of my athletes was doing that, that I would have to speak to him. So again, maybe Gordon's not his coach, but that's just coming out. Then my next question is, which competitions did he see Gordon, Nicky Rod do that an hour and a half before? Was it his match before Luke Rockhold, you know, UFC champion? Was it before his ADCC competition, his breakout year? You know, was it before Muhammad Ali? Was it before Orlando Sanchez? Because if it's before those, any of those matches, those are his, those are Nicky Rod's breakout matches. What really made him famous and big. And that's a significant thing to, change your career. That would be, I would like for Gordon to elaborate more on that, which competitions, which matches was it, which competitions, was it that you've seen, that's just the first thought I have with that. Let's see. Closing thoughts on the event. Sorry for the snorting, clearing my mouth and everything. I apologize. Just being sick. My last things on it, Flow Grappling. Our stream started to bug out a couple times. You know, I know people give Flow a really hard time, but it wasn't bad. It's just going to happen. There's going to be production things. Not complaining about that. Flow's, it streams pretty well, like straight to a TV from the phone app. So that's pretty nice. That's nice. Not complaining about that. UFC Fight Pass, I do think, has a better app, and it runs smoother, but it's related to the UFC, so the UFC is going to be providing something better. I think it's great that ADCC signed the contract with UFC Fight Pass, and then that Gordon signed the contract with Flow, because I think it's good. That just means that there's more good high-level jiu-jitsu pro competition, and whenever there's competition between companies, that's a good thing. It makes both companies deliver a better product for their customers and their everything. So, yeah, that's a great thing that there's competition. Kendall Rusing, these are just my thoughts I had on it. Kendall Rusing, I hope I'm saying her name right. Apologies if I'm not. She's the best commentator. She should commentate on every one of the matches. Maybe she's just saving her energy. It's hard to talk for 3 hours, 4 hours straight and keep the quality up. But she's by far the best commentator that they have on the staff. I really, if it was Kendall and Kyotera, I'd be so much happier than the other two guys. the other two guys, not very good. The guy with the suit that's not tailored to fit him, that guy, I couldn't stand that guy. That guy's terrible. And what I mean by terrible is he just has a Stephen A. Smith style where he says he can say 50 words, but he says nothing. Like, says a whole bunch of words, but nothing. It's just a bunch of generic, excited tropes where he's just raising his voice and he's not actually giving anything. A good commentator will make the competition more interesting. They'll like paint a picture for what's going on and the strategies. And Kendall even like predicted a couple of things like Bodani was doing before he did them, but it's because she's actually good. She knows how to speak. She's actually good at jiu-jitsu. And she has a good brain. And she has a good mouth. She can speak well and she understands what's going on, but yeah, not just saying a bunch of Stephen A. Smith, just oversimplified loud tropes. And again, saying 50 words, but not actually getting anything across. You're not actually saying anything. You're just using a bunch of adjectives and just yelling. And then when you try to make a point, your point's way off. It's not even accurate. Yeah, but Kendall, she's by far way better. But yeah, the guy with the suit that needs to get tailored so it fits properly, that guy, he was my least favorite. But when I first started boxing, for an example, I loved to listen to Roy Jones Jr. commentate on a fight because it made the fight way more interesting, because a 12-round bout can you know, get boring if you don't understand all the setups. But he would walk you through what's going on, the strategy, round number 4, 5, 6, 7. And I also, it helped me learn boxing way faster because it made it more interesting. It does make it more interesting, more fun, but also I was learning because he was explaining what was going on. That's a good commentator. Of course, there, you know, one commentator does have to, you know, do the ads and everything like that. So not holding that against you. That's part of the job as well. And the last thing, I got 1 minute to do this. Gordon backing out because of his flu or illness, sickness thing. That's honestly, I think Felipe Pena should have canceled when Leandro Lowe was murdered. I don't think he should have done that competition. I think that wasn't smart for him. A friend or family or manager or coach should have told him no. I know that Flo pressured him and they offered him more money. They're the ones that pressured him and put him in the really tough spot. I've had that happen to me before by a pro MMA promoter. And it really sucks to when you give up to the peer pressure. But my advice would be, Gordon, it wouldn't be smart for him to compete after just having the flu. He's going to be out of shape. And Penna shouldn't have competed after his best friend was murdered. And any of my athletes, that would suggest for you as well. Sorry I got a short end this really short, but only got 10 seconds. Thanks for listening to the episode. See everybody this week. See you.